We've been on a quest for understanding the history of the church or history of Christianity. We can call it either one. I've called it either and one between the handout and what I have on my slide. But we have are part of a larger endeavor where we've been talking about sort of those initial things that are going on in the formation of the church. We began with sort of the things that led up to the beginning of the church, those forces that were out there that happened to be going on. And we talked about those contributing forces, how they led to that amazing day of Pentecost, and then after that, how the church began to expand. We've talked about the early church period. We've talked about the first century. We've talked about the second century, and we've gotten into the third and fourth centuries. Tonight, we're going to be talking about the councils. And the councils that are of the significant ones of the early church period, because when we begin this quest, when we begin looking at this idea of Christianity, how did it come together, we find that there's a lot of things that are going on that are interesting. There are a lot of personalities at play. And one of the things that we want to look at and we want to be mindful of is how the church came to be. How, and by that I mean the church. I'm using the church, and you'll see, and I want to explain this really quick. The way that I've developed this, there is a capital C church and a lowercase c church. The capital C church means the corporate church. It means the universal church. It is the body of believers that has existed and is existing. It is that larger universal concept. Now, by universal, we don't mean big C Catholic. We mean that it's just all the believers, all the people who have been through Jesus' shed blood, saved and redeemed, and are a part of that body that are called Christians. That is the big C church. Now, the little c church, or churches, is the local expression of that. And as we've worked that out, I might play around, and I wanted to give a little bit of space in case you see me using the big C versus the little c for church versus churches. The little c means the local church. University Baptist Church, if we were to talk about it, is a little c church. Doesn't mean that we're a little church, it just means we're a local body of believers. We believe, and I think that the proper articulation of our doctrine of the church, our ecclesiology, is that we are all a part of a larger universal church that will ultimately meet one time, and when it meets for the first time, it will never stop meeting. And when that one time happens, it's at the end of the age, the eschaton. It is at the marriage supper of the Lamb. It is at when Jesus has come back. It is that time where the church gathers together, all the people. Some people say that the church met once at Pentecost. It'll meet again at the marriage supper of the Lamb. Yes and no, to a degree with that. But the little c church, if we use that tonight, we're talking about the local church. We're talking about the various local churches. And whatever those expressions are. One of the things that we have hopefully been able to discover and that you've been sort of been able to see is that Christianity didn't start off with everybody agreeing on everything. Christianity didn't start off with everybody being in line and saying, this is what we believe, this is who we are, this is what Christianity is. It was a really diverse thing. When we talked 2 weeks ago about the heretics, we saw that the reason that a lot of them existed was, and they had false teaching, is because they were bringing in a lot of stuff from where they had come from, whether it was the Jewish background with the Ebionites, whether it was a sort of a weird over-articulation of Platonic theology and Marcionism, whether it was just all these different things that are coming in with the different positions for the heretics. So ultimately, we talked about the heretics, we talked about why they existed, and then we've also talked about what was going on in the midst of that, how these things are happening, some of the major characters, some of the major things that are going on. One of the things that the church does in the midst of this time, and we'll see that as we're getting into it, it gets into a way that it is able to celebrate its unity through the ecumenical councils. So we're going to be talking about that tonight. We're going to be getting into what is happening, and you'll be following along. I've got some minimal notes behind me. It's really just an outline that'll go right back to the paper. I've got a couple things that we can add to it. But we want to begin because this is ultimately what we're talking about. Whenever you read this, if you're getting into Gonzalez, And as you get into Gonzalez, let me talk a little bit about in this first volume. He does a really good job of trying to stay on task. And it's very hard whenever you're doing history. History is, being a historian, it's a complicated, sort of a complicated task, because there's all these streams of influence. Let's say that we want to talk about the Civil War in the United States. Well, we can start at what day for the Civil War? Does anybody remember? April 12th, 1861. And what happened?
Fort Sumter,
yeah. But do we just start there when we talk about the Civil War? We can't, because we have to talk about what other stuff? We have to talk about slavery. We have to talk about the states' rights issues. We have to talk about secessionists. We have to talk about economic issues, socio-political issues. Then we can begin walking across those five Aprils that happened from 1861 to 1865. And we can talk about it linearly, but then there are some battles that happen at the same time, and we just can't break away from a battle to go to another battle. We have to talk about them and come back to them, and all the stuff that's layered in. Christian history is the same way. We have to talk about it the right way. And if you're trying to keep up with what we're talking about, one of the things that's very important is getting into sort of chapters 13, 14, and 15. That's going to give you a good basis. But really 17 is where they begin talking about the Arian controversy and the Council of Nicaea. And then he is going to go through, and it's really funny, it's sort of between chapter 17 and between chapter 26, he's going to talk about the councils at various places. As Steve and I were talking about getting this together, I thought it would be good to talk about the councils as a whole. So you're going to see at the top of your paper that it says the history of the church, the councils, and the date there is 325 to 787. That's a really broad span of time. No one that was at the first council was at the last council, believe it or not. It's not possible. But there's a lot that goes on there. There's a lot that happens. And the first council looks different than the last council in some ways, even though it was in the same place. The first council is very similar to the last council in some ways. But what becomes important about talking about these councils, these ecumenical councils, is that they become the means by which much of what we believe as Christians, we still hold to. And we can look all the way back at these councils and what they came up with to talk about that and to look and see what's going on. So what's an ecumenical council? So you've got two parts to that. And before you look at the definition that I've given you, the two words there are ecumenical. And ecumenical means what? As we use it today, if you're going to go to an ecumenical gathering, what's that going to mean? It's going to mean church. If you're particularly an ecumenical Christian, that's generally, it's ecumenical. We understand it as being Christian. One of the challenges of our pluralistic society is that oftentimes the media will call an ecumenical body one that is one comprised of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian, the three large monotheistic religions. But what we're talking about here is exclusively Christian, but it means a diversity of Christians. If I go to an ecumenical meeting for any number of reasons, let's say it's together for the Christians together for the gospel or something, you could have Presbyterians there, or Lutherans, or Episcopalians, Roman Catholics, Eastern Orthodox, though they sit on the different side of the room, and you have different, you have Baptists, and some Baptists don't consider us as a denomination, but we're different kinds of Christians. We have non-denominational folks. And what ultimately ecumenical means, it means a diversity of backgrounds. But a council is pretty straightforward. It's a what? It's, give me some key words for, or synonyms for a council. What is a council? It's what? Conference? Yeah, it's a conference. What else?
A rulemaking body.
What else?
Committee.
A committee? Yeah. And these councils are like committees on steroids with all the same problems. It's like they get like roid rage. We're going to talk about that in like the later ones. Because there's like, they bring in the military at a couple points. So there's some stuff that happens. So ultimately, what we see, an ecumenical council is in the history of the church. We'll see this right from our notes. The history of the church from the toleration of Christianity. Now, I threw that phrase in there and I didn't define it. What do I mean by the toleration of Christianity across the Roman Empire? We can add that. The toleration of Christianity across the Roman Empire. What do I mean by that? Emperor Constantine, yeah, the Edict of Milan, 313, the toleration of Christianity. Christianity before Constantine was what? It was illegal. It was illegal. Who were you supposed to worship if you were in the Roman Empire? Caesar. You're supposed to pay tribute to Caesar. Caesar is Lord, not Jesus is Lord. In Christianity, as we talked about last week, it went through some persecutions, varying levels. There's a book out by a very good scholar. It's just a very bad book. Candida Moss, who's a scholar at Notre Dame, she actually has written a book called The Myth of Persecution. Now, the latter part of it, we can get our arms around. The challenge is her historiography, her philosophy of history has been really sort of assaulted because we know that there's persecutions that go on. And it's just because it's Christian documents that they get this from, it doesn't mean that it didn't happen. But there's some very real persecutions that go on. Then all of a sudden, Constantine, who we're going to talk about next week, he goes into battle and he's worried because his troops are outnumbered and this could crush his empire. He's the emperor of the Roman Empire. And he has a vision, and all of a sudden they go into battle and they win. And he says Christianity is now going to be tolerated. It's going to be legal in the Roman Empire. And then not too long after that, Christianity becomes the religion of the Roman Empire. And it's pretty powerful what happens there. And if you walk around Rome, particularly you go down to the old Colosseum area, and you're able to go see a lot of the stuff, you're able to see some really neat things, some older pre-Christian work, plus some later Christian work, and what all happened. Of course, most of the Colosseum, the Colosseum doesn't look really attractive because they took all the marble and put it in the Vatican. So it's actually what happened. It's kind of a fun thing because there's just a straight shot there. But that's sort of what happened because they needed money because St. Peter's wasn't getting built the right way. But anyway, so we see this, the history of the church from the toleration of Christianity across the Roman Empire, and we use scare quotes. They're not really scare quotes. We use quotations here but to say worldwide. Now, why would we use that around worldwide? Because they thought in the Roman Empire they were the world. They thought everything around the Mediterranean was it. That's it. This is all there was. Now, you get into North Africa, and then there's some people that don't speak all of our language a little farther south. You get up in the Germanic regions. We'll convert them later when we have a stronger army. We're going to go into Britain, but we have to go across the English Channel, and that's just, it's weird. There's Robin Hood up there. It's strange. But these were the worldwide gatherings. They thought this was it. This was the primary people for Christianity. These are the worldwide gatherings of leaders to determine critical theological issues and clarify the teachings of Orthodox. I use Orthodox here, and we have to be careful about using, I'm couching all my language. I have to be careful about using Orthodox because sometimes we might think of the Eastern Orthodox Church. That's not what we're talking about. That's a big O. This is little O. This is Orthodox, the accepted teachings of Christianity. They also acted to remove dissenters and heretics who were dividing the church. So that's an ecumenical council. That's a pretty broad definition, I know, and one that can kind of be confusing. But this didn't just arise out of a vacuum. They didn't get together one day and say, hey, you know, we just need to get together and have a committee meeting because that's what we do. And my grandfather, who believed that Baptists went all the way back to John the Baptist, I don't believe that. But he would tell you that's the origins of the Baptist church. It started in the committee. So one of the things that he would talk about in the Trail of Blood is this is sort of the nature of this is how it all worked out. But these ecumenical councils were these large, is qualitative, but it's an influential gathering of leaders across Christianity. And it happens after the toleration of Christianity when it's legal to be Christian. Imagine, if you will, probably the closest thing that we have to understand this is Nazi Germany. That all of a sudden, and we're going to go and we're going to play that, we're going to pretend that we're doing the alternate history. Hitler gets saved. one day, and he decides that he doesn't want to carry out the Holocaust anymore. And he stops carrying out the Holocaust, and he frees everyone from concentration camps. He makes it no longer illegal to be Jewish. And you can walk around without the markings on anymore. That's the kind of difference that happened in the Roman Empire when Christianity went from being illegal to legal in one foul swoop of a quill across parchment, if you will. That's the power of what happens when an emperor gets his life changed, and so forth. So that's really what went on. Now, the Christian church was growing at this time, and there were, at this point, probably several million followers. They were identified as Christians. What were they first called in the book of Acts? Followers of the way, absolutely. But then they became called Christians, and Christians was a mocking term. Why did they call them Christians? Because if you take the two Greek words that make up Christian, which is Christos and Ian, it means little Christ. So when they made fun of them, they said that you're acting like little Christs everywhere you go. You're trying to be like a little Jesus. And Christians were like, yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to do. And what they were trying to do is deride them and mock them. They actually adopted the term, and the Christian church began growing. So as we're able to find it, these things, again, they didn't start out of nothing. This idea of a council, or I'm going to use another term here in a moment, a synod, these ideas of councils came out from, frankly, they've been around for generations. These aren't any new. And if we actually look and we see in Acts 15, which we're not going to take time to really get into tonight, the biblical model for these councils in Christianity is found in Acts 15. Verses 6 through 21, where the topic of whether male Gentile believers needed to be circumcised as a part of their conversion was debated and resolved. There's also an issue of sending spies to bother Paul and Barnabas. But when you go and you look at Acts 15 and what happens, I actually think that the scenario that Paul is talking about in Galatians 2 is actually that council where he had gone to Jerusalem and went before the three. He calls them the three pillars of the faith. There's a lot to unpack there. But it was Peter, it was John, and it was James. And we're not talking about James the disciple. We're talking about James who? The brother of Jesus. Yeah, so he went before those three guys. So it's two apostles and Jesus' brother. And he checks his gospel out. How's your gospel doing? Explain the gospel to us. And what's really interesting, and this is a little apologetic thing for you to put in the back of your head, Galatians 1 and 2 is considered by and large by almost every significant secular scholar to be one of the most historical parts of the New Testament. It is not regularly debated for its historical accuracy. Within that section, the actual gospel is explained. So we know that Galatians, I take an early dating on Galatians, it was probably written in about 45. So we know that Jesus Christ was considered by and large by most of the Christians of that time to have been who have been living in this world, to have died on a cross, and then to have been resurrected on the third day. That was the core of the gospel from the beginning. But all that to say, Acts 15 shows us what a council looks like. It was probably the model that they ended up using. If we had to go and listen, they didn't call it the book of Acts chapter 15, because what didn't they have back then? They didn't have a New Testament yet. They were in the process of getting it. They would have said in Luke's history, that history book that goes along with his gospel, round around the middle, because they didn't have chapters and verses. When did the chapters and verses get installed? Before the printing press, in about the 13th or 15th century, depending upon who you take it from. We're not really sure on who it was. It was some guy. He got half of them wrong in the New Testament, it feels like, because you're like reading along, and you're like, that's not where a chapter break is. But that's okay. But this is one of the things that we see. And if you get into Acts 15, you see how a council began to work. It was a group of leaders. And in that council, in the Jerusalem council, it was all of the elders in the church of Jerusalem. Now, there were probably multiple churches in major cities. And one of the things that would happen in the model of Christianity that would go forward is there would be these large epicenters of Christians that would begin to dominate their regions. One of the first was Jerusalem, because that's where everything happened. A second one was Antioch. Another one was Rome. Another one was, well, Byzantium or Constantinople, which is now known as Istanbul. And one of the things that happened, then you go down and it's Alexandria, And then you even go all the way out to Carthage, and then you can go up to Lyon and what is now France. It used to be Gaul. But that would be the larger, we would call them metropolitans or metropolitan areas where Christianity grew. Now, one of the reasons Christianity grew in those areas is because they were very densely populated. It was hard for Christianity to grow in rural areas. But in these large urban environments, it would grow. And the bishops or the people that would be leading the churches in those areas, and I really believe that there were multiple denominations already by the end of the first century. We see that in Ephesus particularly, where you probably have a Johannine community, a Pauline community, a Lucan community, a Petrine community, all existing within the same city. That one of the things that happens is that they got to get together every now and then and talk about their stuff. And the council became one of the ways that they did this. And so forth. So we see in Acts 15 the model of that, and we're going to just mention that, and then we're going to continue to move on because we want to get to all these. As Christianity grew and expanded, these initial councils were vital to help clarify and purify Christianity. Notice the two things. We're going to bring this up again and again. Councils served two essential purposes, to clarify and to purify. There's a guy out there, and he's not writing about the early church. His name is Patrick Lencioni, probably one of the best leadership writers I've read in a long time. He's got a book called The Advantage. He says the hardest thing for any organization to do is to clarify. The second hardest thing to do for an organization is to clarify. So clarity is hard to get to, but when we're able to communicate clearly, we're able to bring people along with us. But also, one of the things that we run into is that we needed to purify the church, and there's some consolidation that happens there. So ultimately, we see there's some things that happen. There are two kinds of formal ecclesiastical assemblies that happen, synods and councils. Let me read this next little paragraph that I have here. Much of the core of what we believe as Christians today can be traced back to the debates and the decisions of these councils. For instance, and we're going to get into this, we believe Jesus Christ died and then stayed in the ground for 3 days, right? And then after 3 days, somebody stole his body, right? Now, what do we believe? We believe that after 3 days, Jesus what? Rose again. It's not every day that a Messiah comes and is resurrected, contrary to what some misrepresentations in historical scholarship say. But we also believe that Jesus had, he was really just a guy, and he didn't have anything of God inside of him. God just naturally took him in or adopted him into the divine way, right? No, we don't believe that. We believe Jesus was fully human and fully divine. And that in the midst of that, he was able to, and this is the really big fancy term that I'm never going to say again in here, but I'm just going to define it real quick, the hypostatic union, which sounds like it's something that a rapper should be saying. There's actually a guy named Lecrae. He's got a really cool song called The Hypostatic Union. It's pretty awesome. He just came out a couple years ago. I listen to it every now and then. He's a Calvinist, so I don't listen to some of the others. But one of the things that we get into with him is that one of the things we talk about, the hypostatic union, it's the divine, the unity of those natures and how we clarified that. But in the midst of that, we know that Jesus is divine. We also know that he's a part of the diunity, right? The two people of the Godhead? No, it's the how many? It's the three people of the Godhead, because you have God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. Yeah. See, this is the kind of stuff that when we begin talking about it, we're able to say, no, that's a misarticulation of what's supposed to be said. Rather, this is the process that the church went through to clarify and to purify. These councils were vital. Some early councils existed in diverse places. You can find them throughout. We're not going to talk about them, but were mostly isolated. And by the isolated, I mean they didn't draw people in from far, far away. So I've mentioned one in here, for instance, in North Africa, the synods of Carthage in 251 and 252 that were led by Cyprian, dealt with how to restore the lapsed who had fallen away during persecution. That only attracted people around the Carthage area, which is in North Africa. He wasn't drawing people in from Jerusalem and from Athens and from Antioch. He was just those people in that area on how they were going to deal with this issue. It was a synod. One of the more significant synods that happened in 397, the Synod of Carthage, happened, and what they did is they codified the Bible. And they said, these books are the New Testament. The rest of them, some of them are cool to read. Don't read them in church, but they're cool to read, like the Shepherd of Hermas or the Epistle of Barnabas. But then there's some ones that are really sketchy, like the Gospel of Judas, and we're going to do away with that one because it's wrong. It's Gnostic. That's the way that things were done. But larger Christian-wide councils were soon called, but the meetings of these similar regional council, regional synods continued for generations. Synods happen all the time. There are synods that happen every year still today. Who primarily uses synods? What denomination? Lutherans and Presbyterians. I got a real good friend of mine who's a minister up at up at Memorial Drive Presbyterian Church. It's a great church on the west side of Houston. And they recently just got a new pastor, and he had to go through an approval process, not just with the church, but with the synod. Now they have to give some of their money to that. There's some stuff that's going on with that, but good church. These synods still exist. That conciliar body still happens. When was the last ecumenical council, technically? When was the last ecumenical council? We mentioned this a couple weeks ago. It was in the last century. It happened in the 1940s, or the 1960s. It was Vatican II. And who was the primary leader of Vatican II? A guy who would become the Pope named John Paul II. He wasn't John Paul II at that point. A second significant person was a guy named Joseph Ratzinger, who would become Benedict XVI. So one of the things that you see is that there is a process of that. Now, there's a lot of discussion right now within the Catholic realms of having another ecumenical council. They can have it. Doesn't mean anything. It's just going to decide stuff and maybe help them out a little bit, and they're in trouble. But that's something that could happen.
One question. You were talking about how the council then decided what was in the New Testament. And what. Why is the Catholic Bible different than what we look at the additional books?
So the question is, why is the, if they had decided in 397 what the New Testament looked like, why does the Apocrypha exist in the Catholic Bible? You have to go to this Council of Trent, which is in the 1400s, 1200s, and you have to look and see what they did there. There's some additions and all that. I mean, I could talk a lot about the other councils, the First Lateran Council, the Second Lateran Council, the Fifth Lateran Council that contradicted the Second Lateran Council, then the Council of Trent that was part of the Counter-Reformation that was going on, and that really begins, we'll talk about those in a couple weeks. They added all that as a response in many ways to some... A response to the Reformation, but also a response in with some other things that are happening. That's a good question. But one of the things that we see is this conciliar movement happens within early Christianity. And you'll notice this. They are called ecumenical councils because prior to the establishment of the Roman Catholic Church, I don't believe the Roman Catholic Church existed prior to 600. Throw that out there for you. If you've got some Roman Catholic friends, they're going to yell at you. That's okay. They won't yell. Catholics don't. They just cross their arms and just glare. But like a good committeeman. But what they're going to do is they're going to say, well, no, the Catholic Church goes all the way back to Peter. Well, Peter didn't found the church in Rome. I've got a paper I'm working on. I can tell you about that later. It's called Peter Never Slept Here. But how he didn't found the church in Rome because it didn't work out with his life. But I think, and we're going to talk about this next week with Gregory the Great, I don't think that the Roman Catholic Church gets officially started until 600. And we're going to talk about that next week, so come back. But anyways, then, until then, they represented leaders of a diverse Christianity across the known world. And just because they had an ecumenical council about something and made a vote and decided it, didn't make it so. It didn't make it the way that it was going to be. So tonight we're going to focus on the ecumenical councils. We're going to be focusing on these seven. And I've got them listed here. I want to show you real quick this picture that I was able to find. I don't know how good quality it is, but you get an idea. So we see this is sort of the map of the world. It still looks the same way because it still looks the same way. And you'll see, if you can see my little pointer, there's the boot. That's Italy. There's Rome. And then over here, this is the real hotbed of Christianity. If you can see my little pointer that's moving around there. But in the middle of that, you see that there's this thing. There's a couple different ones, Nicaea. And the one, you have Constantinople. And with that, it's number two. Then you have Ephesus, which is number three. Then you have Chalcedon, which is number four. This is not necessarily in chronological order, but you get an idea. These ecumenical councils were still pretty clumped together. Now, why were they all around Constantinople? Because what's Constantinople now called? Used to be Constantinople. They might be giant song about it. But we're thinking about that the whole entire time I'm talking. But it used to be called Byzantium. But then who decided to anchor his empire there? Constantine, so when you are the leader of the known world and you decide to go do something new and move a new capital, what are you going to name it? You're going to name it after yourself. So he took from Rome and he goes to Constantinople, or goes to Byzantium and says, this is going to be called Constantinople, and all the street signs have to change. But he's the king because it's good to be the king. So one of the things that happens is around that area, now there's a reason they did it around that area. One, because it's beautiful. I mean, it's just really nice area. If you've ever been out there, you know, it's really beautiful, even though it's now present-day Turkey. But one of the other things is that they were close to the anchor of the empire, and they could still be controlled. Don't think control's not a part of this. So we're going to talk about them. This is where they generally existed, were the major ecumenical councils. But they would have drawn people from all over Christianity. If you can imagine zooming back out and seeing that whole picture of the Mediterranean region, people from all the way over to what is now modern-day Morocco, up into Spain, up into northern Gaul, what is now France, into the Germanic areas. They would have gone all the way down. Obviously, Lyon was a big one. Then you also had down into Italy. You go into what used to be Yugoslavia, now Slovakia. You have all these kinds of things that they're drawing people from, even into North Africa, even down into Ethiopia. And one of the things that they do is they draw those people in to make major decisions. And we're going to talk about the first seven ecumenical councils. So we're going to talk about them in order that they happen. So we're going to start with Nicaea, and we call it Nicaea 1, because when they met, they didn't know they were Nicaea 1. So, and what I've done is I've pretty much just gone through, and I've given you, as best I can through the notes, the general, the same outline. I want to talk about when did it exist, who called it, because it's important to see who calls it, to see the line that's going on with that. I think it's kind of funny to see how many people they said were there at the councils, just to give you an idea. And you're sitting there saying, well, if by 325 Christianity had suddenly exploded, now was 30 million people, 318 of them made major doctrinal decisions for them. Now, there's a guy out there that wrote a book called The Da Vinci Code, and his name's Dan Brown. And he has a whole bunch of stuff in there about the Council of Nicaea, and most of it isn't true. There's a reason it's a fictional book. But just in case you've read it, you're going to hear a lot of stuff. You're going to hear Nicaea going off in the back of your head. They didn't arrive at the New Testament at Nicaea. They didn't even arrive at the New Testament at Constantinople I. They were getting close. It was probably around, but they were still having discussions about it. There's not this grand conspiracy by the apostles. We know there's not a grand conspiracy by the apostles because they were all martyred for their faith. It's generally not a good conspiracy if you die. Just throwing that out there. So, nevertheless, let's talk about the Council of Nicaea. I'm going to just sort of go down this list, and then I'm going to give you a couple fun stories about them, if I can remember them, and we're just going to get through them, because the councils are kind of fun. We started off, and I think they're genuine at the beginning, and there's some fun things that come out of them, and I'd encourage you, if you're interested, to hop on a website. If you go to that Christian Classics Ethereal Library that I mentioned, you can actually look up a lot of the decisions that are still preserved today. You can look up some of these creeds, the Nicene Creed, the Chalcedonian Creed. We can all go look them up if you want to. There's some really neat things in there. But anyways, it was called by Emperor Constantine, and it was called for two reasons. I'm just going to throw these out there for you, and we're going to talk about it again a little bit next week. There's a very good, legitimate theological reason why it was called, because there's this guy named Arius, and he's causing trouble. The second reason is a political reason, because Constantine needed to get the empire under control. Why do you think the King James Version was created in 1611? There's a very specific political reason why the authorized version, the King James Version, came out in 1611. And when we get to 1611 in February, we'll talk about it and why it happened and why James was a horrible person. And why it was entirely political, why it happened. Because you already had the Bishop's Bible that was out there. You had the Wycliffe Bible that was out there. This is entirely political. But it's still a good translation if you still use it. But it happened in Nicaea, which is now modern-day Iznik, Turkey. If you go there, you're going to see some beautiful stuff. I encourage you, if you're ever interested. If you want a tour guide, I'm free. Need to pay for my flight, and maybe a hotel and board. Year happened in 325. Now, again, 325 is not that separated from 313. It's how many years later? It's 12 years later. So, but then actually 313 was just the beginning. We don't really see the Christianity didn't really become the dominant religion of the Roman Empire until about 320, 323. But then Constantine knows he's got to deal with Arius because Arius is running amok. And traditionally there were about, I should have put for letter D, attendants, not traditionally. Attendance traditionally is thought to be 318, but it was probably more like 250. And one of the things that happened when they would call these was interesting. Now, who's calling this? Who do we know? What's this person's title? Emperor. Yes, which means when they call it, they send emissaries out to all these different areas, all these different regions where there'd be bishops, where there'd be leaders of the church. And it said in the place, the thing that went out, hey, you need to come to Nicaea on this day and so forth. So plan yourself and go, oh, by the way, here's, 15 gold pieces. So bring yourself, your deacon, and your presbyter or your associate pastor. They're not going to be making decisions, but you will. But you're going to give you free passage. So anytime, if there's a train of gladiators going by or a column of gladiators, they'll put you on their horses and they'll help you get there. That's the kind of stuff that was going on when these guys were taken in that's the kind of opportunities that they had. It's almost like we call an ecumenical council in the United States and all the airlines go, oh, if you're a pastor, yeah, bring your whole staff with you. And we're just going to let you ride for free. You can bump people off the airline if you need to. We're not going to call an ecumenical council anytime soon, but that's the kind of thing that would have happened. So the main characters, now these are always important because they're fun people. Arius, Eusebius of Nicomedia, Hosius of Cordoba. Cordoba is actually in Spain. He was the primary, Hosius was the primary religious consultant for Constantine. He had the ear of Constantine. One of the reasons we have a clause in the Nicene Creed is because of this guy. And then Athanasius of Alexandria. Athanasius of Alexandria is one of the most significant theological minds of this era. He's got a real slender book called On the Incarnation. It's very good. It's all about Jesus. It'll help you if you're interested in learning about that. What would happen is Athanasius and Arius would go head to head on this stuff, and there was a lot that went on with that. Some issues and controversies as we get to that. This was talking about the nature of the Father and the Son. Did God create Jesus? The homoousios or the heterousios? Now, what's homoousios or heterousios? Does anyone know for extra credit? You get a big star. Same substance or different substance? Absolutely, that's right. You get a gold star. Ask Dr. Laufer and he'll give it to you. So, homoousios or heterousios? This was the main contention of Nicaea. And in the Greek of the Nicene Creed, you have either a homoousios or a heterousios. And it says something like this: Jesus is the same substance as the Father, or Jesus is a different substance than the Father. And literally those few letters changed everything. And these were some things that were going on. Also, the date of Easter or Pascha was at stake. It was at one point Easter was tied to the Jewish calendar. It was the church wanted to get it off of that and have their own little thing. Also, matters of church discipline, our church offices, discipline and order, but then also quelling some schisms related to believers who fell away during persecutions, and specifically the Miletian schism. So basically, and I'm gonna sort of throw this out there. I'm not gonna come back to it. The way that these guys would meet, it wouldn't happen on a Sunday afternoon. This would happen over the course of weeks and months, and they would get together and they'd have these large-ranging debates, and then they would have speeches, and then they would go to lunch. And then they'd come back and hear more speeches, and they'd go to dinner. And then they'd go hang out for the weekend, maybe do some correspondence, all that kind of stuff. Then they'd come back. At some point, they would begin having debates. They would start engaging with each other. Then they would have votes. Then they had votes upon votes. And it was like it would take a long time to decide stuff. But then they would finally make their decisions, and the results were this. The Nicene Creed was produced. This is a very short creed, only several lines, and it lays out the foundations of the faith, the apostolic faith that had been delivered. Also, Arianism was condemned. This is big deal. This is almost like if we had an ecumenical council today, and we said, all right, all you Episcopalians, you're nuts. We're just saying it in public. you're done. You're not a part of Christianity anymore. Go away. You can't be a Christian if you're an Episcopalian anymore. That's what was decided at this council. That's the this is how significant it is, what's going on there. And then number three, Easter operates separately from the Jewish calendar. And then there was a formalization of ecclesial structures. At this point, from Nicaea, the three primary offices for a local parish in the Catholic Church, in the larger church, was the bishop, the episcopos, who was the head, who was basically the senior pastor, the presbyter, or presbyters, depending upon how big your parish was, which were your associate pastors, and then the deacons, who were the helpers. Those were the three that were existing. You can actually look, and don't think about this also, or don't think about these as just being creedal. Like, they didn't just issue the creed and say, now we're done with it. No, no, no. They issued the creed on the cover page, and then they had 20 canons that followed it. And if there's a lot of this stuff, it's all free on the internet out there. You can actually look up the individual canons and see what they all meant, and you see how this stuff is formed out. So that's what happens at Nicaea. Nicaea is significant because we see really the primary thing that happens there is Arius is dealt with. But just because a council made that decision doesn't mean Arius goes away. His followers, they're significant. There was probably about 1.5 to 2 million followers of Arius across the Roman Empire. That's a lot of people, and they don't live in the world of CNN and so forth. So it takes time, and they have to learn. We have to debate with them. So Constantinople I comes up. Now, this happens. It's called by Theodosius I, and it's held in Constantinople, which is now Istanbul. It happens in 381. There's 150 people that show up. Now, you'll notice I've got something in parentheses there that says it's an exclusively Eastern representation. At this point in the history of the church, we're beginning to deal with West versus East. This will, actually for you guys, it's going to be West versus East. This is going to become a major issue. The Western segment, the Western sector of the church, will ultimately become the Roman Catholic Church. The Eastern sector of the church will become the Eastern Orthodox Church. That becomes more formalized in 1040 at the Great Schism, which they basically became schismatic over using an I as opposed to not using an I. But we won't get into all that until we get to 1040. But one of the things that happens is we look at history, we begin seeing the Western church, the sort of the more Roman-style church, had their stuff together. And you start listening to these debates and you start reading a lot of these authors that are out there, you're beginning to realize that the Western church really has all of its stuff together. The Eastern church, they're dealing with like mystical stuff. They're dealing with stuff that's like questions like, well, did Jesus, was he really the Logos? And as the Logos comes into the flesh, how does the incarnational part of that happen? Did he incarnate the flesh in some kind of quasi-magical ceremony? Or did God come about and just supplant, and like a seed goes into the soil, and that all of a sudden in the manifestation of the incarnation, this framework occurs? It sounds silly, but that's the kind of conversations. It's very existential that happens in the East. In the West, they're all very, it's almost very dogmatic, very militaristic. This is how it's going to be. There's not that much dissent that happens. But Constantinople comes. Now, this is an exclusively Eastern representation. Now, the main characters are the great Cappadocians. And whenever you say great Cappadocians, you need to have bravado in your voice, because these are the three smartest people in the world, theologically, at the time. And it's Basil of Caesarea, Gregory Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nyssa. And these are great theologians of the time. But then there's another guy, Miletus of Antioch, that comes about. The controversies that go on, it was the final settlement of the Arian problem. Arianism was still going on. It wasn't happening in the Western side of the church. It was happening in the Eastern side of the church. It was still out there. It was still around Antioch. You can find a couple Arians in the suburbs of Jerusalem, and you're like, they're weird. They're Arians. But the problem with heretics is they happen to usually get a lot of followers. They build big churches off of freeways, and they just have people come into the doors. What happened, then they also had to deal with Apollinarianism. Now, we talked about Apollinarianism a couple weeks ago. It was a new heresy that was trying to accommodate, this is the funny way that heresies work, it was a new heresy that was trying to accommodate some of the old heresies. And ultimately asked the question, what is Christ's nature? And then you had the place of the Holy Spirit within the Trinity. Ultimately, the results, Arianism is finally dismissed. We affirmed Jesus as fully God, fully man. They reissued the Creed of Constantinople. Now, the Creed of Constantinople takes the Nicene Creed and adds clarifying lines. And if you look at the Nicene Creed and the Constantinople Creed, you see that it's just a little bit bigger. And because they've added some clarification. And it began to shift a power towards Rome over Constantinople, because we begin seeing the Romans have their stuff together. People in Constantinople, they can't even figure out their name. Byzantium, Constantinople, I mean, what are they going to do here? So these are the things that are happening. Now, then we go down to Ephesus 1. This is called by Theodosius II, who was ironically related to Theodosius I. This was held in Ephesus. And you'll notice there's some, we're seeing some larger segments, some larger gaps in between these councils. This happens in 431. The attendance was 200 on June 22nd, but 250 on July 10th. One of the things that happened is the army came in and prohibited 50 of the people from coming into the building, because there are some people that had some influence with the army, and they're like, you don't want these guys to come in because they're going to make a decision about you guys and your salvation. So the army held them back until the emperor finally came in and said, you guys need to go away, and because it's good to be the king, the army went away, then the other 50 come in, and they start making decisions. The main characters here are Cyril of Alexandria, Nestorius, and John of Antioch. The issues and controversies. Antioch versus Alexandrian Christianity. This is ultimately the Christology becomes the doctrine of Christ becomes the key issues that are happening. The doctrine of Christ becomes what is ultimately being discussed from here forward. Is it the Antiochian version of Jesus or the Alexandrian version of Jesus? And there's a lot of theological baggage between those two. How should we understand Christ's natures? Antioch said that Jesus had two complete natures. The Alexandrians said he had one unified personality. And then there were some issues with Nestorianism that were going on. Ultimately, the results of this were that Nestorius and Callistus were declared heretics. Mary was to be known as the Theotokos, the birther of God, as opposed to the Christotokos, which is the bearer of Jesus. There's a difference here. And the language is important. But then we see this. Jesus is one person with two natures. And the divide of the east and west segments of the church really begins. Antioch versus Alexandria. Constantinople versus Rome. We begin seeing that divide that's going on with that. And what you see here is in Ephesus, there is a very significant move that begins happening. Now, there's a lot of duplicity that goes on. And in between, now, but with this, because there are people that are very powerful. These are people with influence. But there's a lot of things that begin happening in these regions and all this stuff, and people start trying to do some stuff. Ultimately, the issues that are going on between Nicaea 1 and now the next council that we're going to talk about, which is Chalcedon in 451, this is the Christological creation. This is how we understand who Jesus Christ is theologically. And from Nicaea to Chalcedon, there's some amazing stuff that's written about who Jesus is. And there's, we really begin to understand properly who he is and why he exists. And then in Chalcedon, we see that Emperor Marcian called them, and it was in 451. This was held in Chalcedon, which is now modern-day Kadıköy, Turkey. And 350 people attended. Chalcedon becomes the most significant council of the seven in understanding who Jesus is, because we arrived at the decisions and they settled these decisions. The main characters were Theodoret of Antioch, Discorsus of Alexandria, and Leo I, who is the Bishop of Rome. The Bishop of Rome is also now known as the Pope. Francis is the Bishop of Rome, in case you didn't know. The issues and controversies, the settlement of key Christological questions. Then they needed to reconcile the Synod of Constantinople and the Council of Ephesus II. Now, you'll notice I haven't created the Council of Ephesus II in this list, because the Council of Ephesus II is known as the Robber Synod. It was called by 50 people, and it was done under the cover of darkness. And basically what they tried to do is they tried to banish all the Orthodox people in all the Orthodox leaders in Christianity. It's like if Congress got together for their regular sessions, but then in the meantime, like a third party had risen up of like 45 people between the two houses, and they were like, all the rest of you are fired. Well, it's not going to hold water, but they're going to try. And this is what ultimately Ephesus II tried to do, but they had to resolve this. But then they also had to deal with the Eutychian issues. Eutychianism was a particular kind of heresy. Refer back to 2 weeks ago. Ultimately, the results of this were they affirmed the Synod of Constantinople in 448, and they dismissed the so-called Robber Synod of Ephesus in 449. It produced the Great Chalcedonian Creed that becomes the standard statement on Christology moving forward, and it condemned Eutychianism. They issued 30 canons clarifying church hierarchy, conduct, liturgy, and other significant ecclesial functions, and they made, now this one, number five, is huge, and it made the Bishop of Rome the primary bishop over all the other metropolitan bishops. And the Bishop of Rome is known as the, yeah, so this is really where we start seeing Rome get traction. The problem was, is in between Chalcedon and Constantinople too, what happens? Rome falls. Yeah, that's a bit of a problem. Yeah. So we go to Constantinople too, and we'll run through this real quick. It was called by Justinian in the year 553 and was held in, surprisingly, Constantinople. And there was about 152 leaders that came. Eutyches, the patriarch of Constantinople, Leontius of Byzantium, which is a different place than Constantinople, and Vigilius, the bishop of Rome, were the main characters. Vigilius didn't attend, but he was a main character because he wrote a lot of letters. But the major issues was monophysitism, the one nature versus the two natures argument. This is specifically the three chapters. I'm not going to get into the three chapters. And ultimately was affirming Chalcedonian Christology. What the results were was the affirmation of Chalcedon's two natures doctrine, accepted Cyril's hypostatic union, you'll notice that, of the two natures. And all of this is contained in all of this, and by all of this I mean all the natures are contained in one flesh. One person, and it created a schism within the church. Schisms are starting to happen. And then this is the things that happened. Then we get to Constantinople III, which happened between 680 and 681. The main characters here are Pope Agatho, the Patriarch George I, Marcianus, the Patriarch of Antioch, Sophronius, Patriarch of Jerusalem. The issues and controversies, monothelitism deals with Jesus' will. They're struggling. We're getting, as opposed to dealing with areas up here, now we're getting down to the lower issues, and there's arguments over minor little things at this point. They're still important. But the results ultimately were that they affirmed in Chalcedon, and they amended the two wills along with the two natures, and they settled the controversy and helped the church remain unified. Then finally, we get to the last one, in Nicaea 2 in 787. This is now we're in the early medieval period. It's called by Constantine VI. There's about 350 people there in 787. We had our main characters. But the primary issue here was this, that people were going through churches throughout the Mediterranean region and destroying icons, paintings, and marble statues because they said icons, paintings, and marble statues are wrong. And what ultimately this is called iconoclasm. We don't have marble statues of Jesus that we bow down and worship. We don't have icons that are painted that we walk up to and kiss and ask for their blessing. Because we don't believe that icons have any power over us. But this is where we start seeing the church start getting off the rails a little bit. They said it's okay to go up and kiss a painting and receive a blessing from it. It's okay to go up to a statue and kiss its feet and pray that the statue of Mary will intercede for you. It's okay for these things to happen across the empire. Ultimately, what happens here is that people aren't real sure about this. They're like, I don't know what's going on here. And the results are this. They affirm the use of icons or images. Images aren't to be worshipped, but they may be kissed and bowed down before. I don't know what the difference is. You either worship it or you bow down and kiss it. In the West, Charlemagne, who we're going to talk about in a couple weeks, accepted it but called a council to clarify. In the East, man, they eat up icons. If you go to an Eastern Orthodox church, it's like your Windows desktop never got cleared. There are icons everywhere. One of the things that happens, I mean, they've got these paintings all over the place. And if you've seen it, you know what they all look like. They have it's very 2D paintings, very with the symbols and all that stuff over their heads. That's ultimately what happens. This gives you a real quick short shrift, probably, of the councils. Next week, we're going to talk about world changers. We're going to talk about Constantine. We're going to talk about Gregory the Great, and then we're going to talk about Muhammad. So thank you for your time tonight.